The following podcast will contain spoilers, tangents, hot takes, and excessive foul language. Viewer discretion is advised. Enjoy the show.
Greetings, horror fans, and welcome to episode 240 of Frightmares. I'm your host, Austin Proctor, and joining me for John Carpenter's Halloween 1978 is someone who has a name very similar to Michael Myers. It's Michael Viers from the Shameless Picture Show. How are you today, this early morning on January 1st at 10:12?
The amount of shit that I would get for this being my favorite movie when my name also kind of fits within the rhyme scheme is embarrassing.
Viers,
like, is that what's your favorite movie? No, just happens to be that way.
Well, yeah, and that's exactly why you're here today. My opinion on it really hasn't changed, but my rating did change a bit. So there's that. It seems to change every time I rewatch it. I still don't see it ever being my favorite, but it has moved up in the rankings. And we'll go into that once we go into our rating.
Oh yeah, I got questions for you, but we'll get to that when we get to that.
I've been wondering if I should start doing the ratings at the beginning or save them for the end. I still haven't decided. I don't know if
I kind of still like them at the end because okay. here's the reason why. Or I guess you could always do them twice, but the reason I like them for the end is because, well, you've listened to my show. Sometimes me and Nick or me and my guests will come into the movie with a certain perspective. And by the end, after talking about it, it sometimes will go up, it will go down. So I like ending with it being like, here's our entire discussion. Here's what I gave.
That's true, because I have had instances multiple times where we've been talking about a movie, and then by the end of that episode, I'm like, you know what? After this conversation, I'm raising it. All right, so we'll keep that for the end. But yeah, it has cracked into my top five now, so that's
of all time?
No, just of the Halloween franchise. It is now it's now in my top five.
It wasn't even in the top five of the franchise.
No, it used to be. It used to be like 10, and then it moved up to 7. Now it is at number.
I have so many questions. Let's get past the bullshit so I can ask you questions.
So new year, kind of same podcast. I'm not going to be doing horror news as much anymore because we usually do that's usually about 15, 20, sometimes 30 minutes. So we're basically going to be getting right into stuff. But this is January Carpenter, which is the theme for this month, where we are reviewing all movies directed by John Carpenter. I do have some, I'm going to try to do some, when I have a director themed month like this month, I'm going to try to do some facts about him, or her, and we are going to be, you know, just kind of talking about the filmmaker, himself in this instance. So without further ado, let's talk about John Carpenter, a man born on January 16th, 1948. His birthday is coming up. He is an American filmmaker and composer, most commonly associated with the horror, action, and sci-fi genres of the 1970s and 80s, and is generally considered a master of the horror genre, which I think we can all agree with that. Carpenter usually composed or at least co-composed the music in most of his films. He won a Saturn Award for Best Music of the film soundtrack Vampires, 1998. He also released 4 studio albums titled The Lost Themes, Lost Themes 2, Anthology Movies Themes, 1974 to 1978, and Lost Themes 3, Alive After Death. So he does stuff. Like I said, he was born January 16th, 1948, in Carthage, New York, the son of Milton Jean and Howard Ralph Carpenter, a college music professor. He and his family relocated to Bowling Green, Kentucky during 1953 when his father took a job as a music professor at Western Kentucky University. For much of his childhood, John and his family lived in a log cabin on Western Kentucky University's campus. So that's fun. I did not know he lived in Kentucky for a lot of his life. John Carpenter was interested in films from an early age, particularly westerns of Howard Hawks and John Ford, as well as 1950s low-budget horror films such as The Thing from Another World and high-budget sci-fis like Godzilla and the Forbidden Planet. He also began filming horror shorts with an 8mm camera even before starting high school. Carpenter then graduated from high school before enrolling at Western Kentucky University for 2 years as an English major and history minor. Wanting to study filmmaking, which no university in Kentucky offered at the time, he transferred to the University of Southern California's School of Cinematic Arts during 1968. He would ultimately drop out of school in his final senior semester to make his first feature film. So that's a little backstory on John Carpenter. I have a couple more things here about him. His first major film as a director was a movie called Dark Star from 1974. It was a science fiction comedy that he co-wrote with Dan O'Bannon, who later went on to write Alien, borrowing freely from much of Dark Star. The film reportedly cost only $60,000 and was difficult to make as both Carpenter and Dan O'Bannon completed the film by multitasking, with Carpenter doing the musical score, as well as the writing, producing, and directing, while O'Bannon acted in the film and did the special effects, which apparently caught the eye of George Lucas, who hired him to do special effects for the film Star Wars. Carpenter received praise for his ability to make low-budget films. Let's talk about Halloween real quick. It was a commercial success and helped develop the slasher genre, as we all know and have talked about on this podcast. Originally, an idea suggested by producer Irwin Yablans titled The Babysitter Murders, who thought of a film about babysitters being menaced by a stalker. Carpenter took the idea and another suggestion from Yablans that it occurred during Halloween and developed a story. Carpenter said of the basic concept, quote, Halloween night, it has never been a theme in a film. My idea was to do an old haunted house film. Which, on this watch, after reading that, I get exactly what he was trying to do, because there are a lot of jump scares in this movie. I didn't really realize it until I had my surround sound fucking just cranked, and it was like, boom! I'm like, that's a jump scare.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting once you know that.
Yeah, so I thought that was fun. Carpenter, again, worked with a relatively small budget, around $300,000. The film grossed more than $65 million, making it one of the most successfully independent films of all time. So that is your little background there on John Carpenter, the master of horror. So I've got a new little sound effect here. Let's move on to the IMDb roundup. Yes, whip crack. That is all your idea too, sir. that came from what? You. Yeah. When I was doing an episode, I was like, let's go on to the IMDb roundup, and you were like, you need to like a whip crack or something like that.
I forgot.
So that's all you. IMDb roundup, baby. That. Have we seen this prior to this viewing? Duh. It's one of his favorite movies, and it's I've seen this. I mean, I've been watching this for a long time. It's Halloween from 1978, released on October 27th of that year in the U.S. Rated R, we've got moderate sex and nudity, moderate violence and gore, mild profanity, mild alcohol, drugs, and smoking, and severe frightening and intense scenes. Has a runtime of an hour and 31 minutes. It's brisk. Listed as a horror thriller directed by John Carpenter, obviously. Also written by John Carpenter. Also written by Deborah Hill, who wrote The Fog, Halloween 2, and Escape from L.A. Composed also by John Carpenter. Who else is going to compose his movies besides the man himself? Cinematography by one of my favorite cinematographers, Dean Cundey, or Cundey, however you say his name. Like, correct me. How do you say
it? I always say Cundey, okay. But I don't know. And not that I'm bragging, I met him as well, and I never got a chance to ask him.
Oh, no. Yeah.
He took my business card, though, so that was cool.
So we'll go with Dean Cundey, who is the fucking man. He has done things like The Fog, Escape from New York, Halloween 2, The Thing, Halloween 3, Psycho 2, Back to the Future 1 through 3, Big Trouble in Little China, Jurassic Park, Casper, Apollo 13, Flubber, The Parent Trap. I could go on and on and on and on.
Back to the Future.
Yeah, BTTF 1 through 3. Oh, yeah. I could literally go. He has done so much. He's done like, a few hundred things or like 100 things. He's done a lot of shit. We've got edited by two people, Charles Bornstein, who also edited The Fog, Howling 2, Your Sister is a Werewolf, Return of the Living Dead 2, Critters 2, he likes doing twos, Psycho 4, and Tales from the Hood. And then we've got Tommy Lee Wallace, who only edited The Fog other than this movie, but he did direct Halloween 3, Fright Night Part 2, and It from the 90s. Starring Donald Pleasence as Loomis, who did so much. I'm not even going to get into all the things he did. He has 242 acting credits. The man is a fucking legend. Jamie Lee Curtis as Laurie. You should know who she is. I mean, this is pretty much what made her famous. This was her first TV, or sorry, her first movie. She had done TV before this, but this was her first actual silver screen performance. Then we've got Nancy Keyes, I believe her name is, or Keyes, as Annie, who only did three things. But she was also in Halloween 2 as Annie and Halloween 3 as Linda Chalice. We got PJ Souls as Linda, who's also in Carrie as Norma. And then we've got Charles Cyphers as Brackett, who was also in Assault on Precinct 13 as Starker. This is where it gets weird because Wikipedia said it cost about $300,000 to make. IMDb says about $325,000. But then it gets weird because the worldwide box office gross on IMDb is only 47.2, but Wikipedia is 65 million. So I'm not sure which is accurate. Those are two kind of wildly different numbers. So we'll just say it made somewhere between 47 and 65. At the end of the day, what you need to be focused on is how much it made compared to how much it cost. That is incredible. Like, yeah, that is an incredible amount. Even 47 million is still like wildly impressive for not even a half a million dollar budget. So this movie was filmed in L.A. and South Pasadena, California, not in and not in Illinois. And you can tell by all the palm trees. You can watch this on Shudder. And movies that came out around the same time, we've got Piranha, Up in Smoke, Midnight Express, Attack of the Killer Tomatoes, The Wiz, and I Spit on Your Grave. IMDb summary: 15 years after murdering his sister on Halloween night in 1963, Michael Myers escapes from a mental hospital and returns to the small town of Haddonfield, Illinois, to kill again. So, overall thoughts on the movie. This is your favorite. Look, so is this your favorite movie of all time or Halloween movie of all time?
Yes.
Okay, that answers that question. Oh, got it.
So it's my favorite movie of all time, and it's not to say it's like the single greatest movie I've ever seen of all time. It's just the movie that had the biggest influence on me. It's the movie I've spent the most time studying, just looking at, figuring out how things were done, and I never tire of it. I know so much of the dialogue by heart. I got the timing down. Like, I know this movie so fucking well. It's definitely like a neurodivergent fixation on this movie, where I just, like, I've listened to so many of the commentaries. I know so much about it. It's just, so that's the reason I always say it's my favorite movie. Is like, have I seen better movies? Yeah, I'm sure I have.
Right.
But very few movies have had the impact on me that John Carpenter's Halloween did. And it all came completely by accident. I was just happy walking through the Target and I saw a DVD edition of it. It was the one with the holographic case. If physical media fans out there remember that one. And I bought it on a whim. Never seen it. I've seen bits and pieces of all the Halloween films before that, because they used to come on AMC. AMC used to do the Halloween marathon. So I'd seen bits and pieces. I knew who Michael Myers was, but I never watched that original film.
Okay.
So, and then I've been obsessed with it ever since.
So how?
It's one of like two movies. Like, I watched it all the way through. I was blown away, and then I watched it again all the way through. It was like two movies I've ever done that with.
Wow. How old were you when you first saw it then?
Let's see. I was in middle school.
Okay. So that's like 10 to 13.
I definitely wasn't old enough to actually buy that movie.
But they let you buy it?
Yeah.
Target
gave notebooks.
I was going to say, the early 2000s. So then, yeah, much earlier than me, I probably didn't see it. Was like the shot. I don't know. I didn't see that until much or like later in life, I don't think. And it's not like I didn't have access to it. It's just like that thing. If no one ever mentions a movie around me and I never seek it out myself, I'm just not going to see it. I mean, that's what happened to fucking Titanic. I saw that for the first time last year. No one ever had it. No one ever brought it up. I knew about it. I never seeked it out. And I think that's just kind of what happened with Halloween. And when I saw it, I mean, I liked it. I thought it was a great movie, but my overall thoughts on the movie is something. This is something that I have grown to over time like more. It's like The Shining for me. I hated The Shining when I first saw it. I mean, I didn't hate this when I first saw it, but I was like, "Oh, The Shining is so boring." Ugh. And then I eventually started loving it more over time, and now that's like my favorite horror movie of all time. Every time I watch Halloween, I swear it just like it goes up. It had like a 3 for me, then it had like a 3.5. So every time I watch it, it seems to go up. So maybe there's just something about the nostalgia with this movie for people, and that's why they like to rewatch it and rewatch it. And it becomes, I mean, you were infatuated right away. So maybe for me, since I saw it later and it was something that was just not on my radar for a while, I'm pretty sure. I don't think I saw Rob. Did I see Rob Zombie's first? I might have seen Rob Zombie's
first.
It
was also just a big film for me because it was when I started getting into horror movies.
Okay. Yeah.
It was like I had a fascination with them, but I was too scared to watch them when I was young.
Yeah, that's kind of how it was for me.
So this one, I remember buying it thinking, I'm going to watch this fucking movie the way through.
I'm doing it. Yeah. So, okay. So you have pretty much no dislikes then for this movie.
Oh, I can be critical on it. Okay. Don't get me wrong. I can be critical on it, but it's nothing that like hinders the film for me.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So there's obviously I have likes and dislikes. Like I love the opening credits scene with the pumpkin. I love just the opening scene. I think that's a great time. I also love the closet scene. Like there's so much I do like about this movie. The score obviously is great. Just
expertly crafted moments.
What's that?
There's so many expertly crafted.
Oh moments. Yeah. Like the camera work in this is fucking unreal. And I'm pretty sure it was Kundi's like first movie DPing for.
Not his first, but it was pretty early for him. Yeah, he had done a handful of movies before that. Like famously, if you listen to my show, The Shameless Picture Show, he did a movie that me and Josephine love called The Witch Who Came from the Sea. And he DP'd the fuck out of that movie. Because he came in and kind of replaced the guy who was making that movie. Because the guy came in and was making that movie, turned out to be kind of incompetent. And Dean Kundi was like, hey, I have all my own gear. Can I just come in and shoot this movie? And I think he's technically uncredited. Ken Gibb gets the actual credit. But Ken Gibb was a pornography filmmaker who made such movies as Anal Alice. And Laying Down the Law.
Oh God!
Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and so on and so forth.
Oh my!
Fertilize the Blaspheming Bombshell. You know, shit like that. So Dean Kundi is like, I have all my own gear. Can I come in and shoot this? They like, please,
for the love of God. It.
Yeah, and then he also did another movie called Black Shampoo, and he did Human Tornado, and then kind of led up to doing this.
So he did a couple things. I couldn't remember. This is someone's first credit. I couldn't remember whose it was, but
Jamie Lee Curtis.
Oh yeah, that's right. That's who that was. There we go. I already said that. There's a bunch.
That's more information than you needed.
No. I think I did need that, honestly. Fucking what was his name for the other one? What was the other cinematographer's name with the porn?
Ken Gibb. Oh, I go into a long list of his best film credit titles on the What You Came from the Sea episode.
Fucking A. All right. I love it. There's a bunch of stuff I do like, but my dislikes for me, I know this is what a lot of people love about this movie. And I think I may have seen Rob Zombie's before because I got into horror late. Rob Zombie's was 2007 and I know I saw that in theaters. So it's entirely possible that I saw Rob Zombie's before I saw the original. I don't like there's no motivation for killing. I don't like that. I usually can deal with mystery.
I do not like that at all. That's one of my favorite elements.
See, and that's where I know huge line in the sand where I'm on the other side and everyone's on the other. But like I'm pretty sure that's why I like zombies because I think I did see that one first and then I watched this one. I'm like, what do you mean? There's no explanation. He just started killing and then the whole. Yeah. And then the escape for me was just that was too quick as well. They show up, everyone's in the yard. He jumps in the car, drives away. How the fuck did he learn how to drive? He's been in a mental asylum for 15 years.
He's doing a very good job last night.
Yeah, exactly. Loomis. So there's just some things I'm like, I would have liked a little bit more of an escape scene. Like Loomis shows up and then he breaks out. It was just the cold open is what I'm calling it. It just felt so rushed for like 10 minutes and then. And then they did a nice job like pacing it out. But like, I just feel like the escape was so rushed. And then how quickly Michael becomes bad at killing when he tries to kill Jamie Lee. He killed everyone flawlessly before that. And then he gets to Jamie Lee and like gets her arm and she falls over the stairs. And then he like misses her on the couch completely. I'm like, and then she is backed into a closet. And he still can't manage to kill her. I'm like, what happened to you? You were just massacring.
Well, here's the thing: she's the only one who fought back.
I guess, but he was.
Because if you think about it, It all comes down to reflexes, because almost every one of these kills, he got them from behind.
He was behind her, and he went to go, and he missed, and I'm like, you could have had her, you son of a bitch.
I thought about this myself, and there's a small little moment, like when his face gets revealed, that an amazing shot of when his face gets revealed from the darkness. He's breathing pretty fucking heavy.
Yeah.
So I assume she hears it.
Okay.
And just reacts to it.
I'm glad.
But that's only it. Like, she just reacts faster than the other two. That's the only reason she's alive. And then from there, she can keep her momentum going.
Yeah.
He's not like some trained killer. He's a dude who has the mind of a child who just has a knife.
It just has a big ass knife. I'm glad you brought that scene up, because I don't know why I forgot about that scene, but like, you see his face clear as day for a hot minute. And I love that people were bitching and moaning about Rob Zombie's Halloween 2. We're like, you can see his face. I'm like, bitch, you saw his face in the original. Not broad daylight, but directly in the light for about 5 seconds, I want to say. It popped off, and he's like, oh shit, and then he pulls it back on. So I think it's funny that people wanted to complain about that in Zombies, but I'm like, it happens in the original. What the fuck?
I was talking about the closet scene where his face gets revealed in the dark.
I was talking about when the mask when the mask gets pulled completely off.
They show his face in pretty much every movie.
I know, so I don't know why they had to single out zombies, but you know, we're zombie apologists. So what are some things that you just really enjoy about this movie? Like I said, camera work, score. That's
some of the biggest things. The pacing of this film is paced unlike a lot of other movies that came out from the time. And I think reason for it is John Carpenter just set out to make a really good movie. Not to say the others don't. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that other people are setting out to not make good movies. But John Carpenter, while he liked horror, it wasn't his goal to become a horror director. So he was just trying to make the best possible movie he can. Whereas everything that came after Halloween was like, how do we make the best possible ripoff of Halloween?
Yeah, basically.
And hell, even Sean Cunningham just is like, well, Halloween's the biggest movie going on right now. Let's rip that shit off.
Yep, let's make another one. Yeah, again, because that's what happened in the 80s. He had that big boom of slashers in the 80s.
I think it just kind of came from a pretty pure place. And you know, John Carpenter, I also understand John Carpenter's mindset at the time. You know, he had made two films before this. He was trying to break into Hollywood. He is a film school brat, which in the 70s that was even a bigger thing, because you're exposed to all this new film and stuff that because you think about it, 1978 home video wasn't really around. Mm-mm. So if you weren't seeing shit when it came out, you'd missed it. Whereas you go to film school and they're like, oh, here's these old, let's show you this Howard Hawks Western, and then let's contextualize it and teach you what this movie's actually about. And let's bring in Howard Hawks to fucking talk about it.
Right.
So then you have all these pretentious ass fucking tastes. And I say this with love, because I'm the same bougie ass filmmaker that John Carpenter is. And it just kind of opens your mind up. And then you're automatically thinking about, how do I elevate this? Like, because he's probably given the script and, or not given the script, he's probably given the concept, and he's like, okay, this is kind of, you know, trite. Let's go write something that, you know, was a little bit different than what we're seeing. And if you also think about it, a lot of horror at this time was, you know, it was about adults in either, you know, gothic castles, or, you know, they did have stuff in like people's homes and shit, like The Exorcist. But like, this is the first one that was about, not the first, but one of the most prolific films about teenage girls in the fucking suburbs.
Yeah, in the suburbs.
Kind of an untouched territory.
Really, the only thing I can think of that did it before it was Black Christmas, but I'm pretty sure that was college. Yeah,
those are college students.
Those are college students.
And they're still quote unquote adults.
Yeah.
Lori is 17.
Yeah, I think Jamie Lee
maybe
was
16.
Yeah. Well, she was.
So the actress, she was old. She was an older than that.
Okay, like, so they just made her. Yeah, she was. They were in high school. So.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah.
My hot take on this really isn't really a hot take. It's just, it's not my favorite Halloween movie, but everyone knows that at this point. But like I said, the ratings did go up on this, and I can see it probably going up again the more I watch it. It's gone up.
So like, let me ask you a couple of questions. I'm sorry, yeah. I'm derailing your show.
No,
what is your favorite Halloween? I'm just morbidly curious. Oh, what is your favorite Halloween?
It's one that is gonna, it doesn't even make sense, because it doesn't have Michael Myers, but it's Halloween 3.
Okay, what's your favorite with Michael Myers?
Rob Zombies.
Okay. And is it just because you didn't like no, there's more. I'm overly simplifying it. So,
yeah.
But was the crux of it really that you just, and if I'm just putting words in your mouth, that you felt uncomfortable that you didn't have more motive?
That's just my biggest thing. Yeah, that is probably the biggest thing. I don't mind mystery and wondering, but like when you have someone that was human at one point. That, you know, he was a kid at one point. Like, you gotta give me something there. Like, that makes me absolutely insane. Like, because even Jason had a reason for, I mean, the reason is not that great. It was, you know, kill for mother, basically. Like, get back at the kids. But, like, there was a reason there. He's getting back at all the people. I mean, and the people that he is killing have nothing to do with the killings.
Well,
so,
and then, well, like, how do you feel about then John Carpenter having to retcon his own movie in the second one? Because John Carpenter said the worst thing he has ever done to that franchise was make Michael and Laurie related.
Oh yeah, because I was about to bring that up. I actually switched Halloween 2 with Halloween in my ranking system and switched their rankings as well. Because yeah, I remember when I saw the ending, I was like, you know what, that would have been such a great point to never make another movie again. But the fact that they came back for 2 and kind of had to retcon things and then made them brother and sister in the sequel, I thought that happened in the first one. I was like, no, wait, that is the second one, isn't it? And so yeah, like that. Then I was like, you know what, that Halloween, that's got to go down for me, because that is kind of silly. And he didn't. And most people think he directed the second one.
Nope,
Rick Rosenthal. He did not direct the second one. I mean, I think he wrote for it, but
yeah, he wrote it, and he said he got really ripped on beer, and he got fucked up and wrote it in 2 days. I think there's actually a Bud Light commercial out there that you could watch that is like John Carpenter writing Halloween.
Oh my god, that's fucking great.
If you look it up, it's great. Well, here's the thing. I guess the reason it doesn't bother me is it feels honestly, for me, it makes it scarier. It's like,
yeah, that's, yeah,
you know, like it's like serial killer aspect. It's like, you know, I live in Wisconsin, man. We have two prolific serial killers from this state.
Mm-hmm.
Ed Gein and Jeffrey Dahmer. And Jeffrey Dahmer specifically would just kind of like, for lack of a term, haunt his area and just pick random people. They're like, it, that to me makes it far scarier.
But those people typically have a bad
deep-seated motive.
But they at least have some bad upbringing, and that's what Halloween Zombie did. He gave it where the reason this kid is like this is he had a shit childhood, which is what most serial killers have. I mean, I'm sure there's people out there that just want to kill, but I'm sure it stemmed from some sort of childhood something, unless they're just born and they're just completely messed up. But yeah, so that's where everyone makes it scarier for them. Doesn't make it as scary for me, because it's like, okay, yeah, he just snapped. What caused the snap? Because he just killed his sister. And it really makes it silly, because when they do mention that their brother and sister in the sequel, because I was like, how is that? Was there a baby that was being watched by someone that wasn't there? Because I mean, at the house, it was only, you know, sister, boyfriend, and Michael. So where was that baby at? Did they not have that baby yet? This doesn't make any sense, you silly gooses. Why are you making them brother and sister? And then they completely retcon that in the 2018 one. They were like, yeah, that was just something, that was just a rumor. Yeah. And I was like, Jesus Christ, we're retconning retcons at this point. Like, yeah, oh my god,
retcon it all.
Did you have a specific moment of horror in this movie that you really, really enjoy?
So there's so many that are so fucking good for me. But the scene that I've like analyzed the most, because I just think it's fucking pure filmmaking, is the scene. So it's after both Annie and Linda have been killed, and Laurie is getting progressively more worried that she hasn't heard from her friends. And she decides after little Tommy and little Annie go to bed. Wait, did I get that name right? Lindsay. Little Tommy and little Lindsay go to bed. She's like, well, let me go over there and take a look. And there's that scene where it's just two shots. It's a nice medium shot of her walking across the street. They got the Panaglide following her. She's a little tense because she hasn't heard from her friends, but she's ultimately still feeling pretty relaxed. She got her hands in her pocket, And then it cuts to her perspective as this house grows larger and larger in the frame. Mm-hmm. And it's, I think it's just this pure fucking filmmaking scene where we as the audience have superior position,
mm-hmm.
and we know there is evil in that house. And Lori's just walking, essentially walking to the slaughter and has no idea what's to come. Because we know Michael's in that house. She doesn't even know he's a threat. She doesn't know her friends are dead.
Yeah.
She knows nothing.
That's funny. That kind of is like a handshake with my horror moment, because my horror moment is when she's going through the house and discovers all the bodies. Now she's come to the realization of what's happened. And you have the guy who like falls down through the doorway. You have, I think.
Oh, it shows that Michael Myers has got a sense of humor.
Yeah. Like
he's a child and at heart. Friday, he's playing.
Friday the 13th definitely took some notes from that, because they do that shit at the end of every Friday movie where the person just discovers all the bodies. So that was, I was like, damn. And then, you know, they have the whole end scene. Favorite kill, I feel like it's everyone's favorite kill, is the knife through chest hanging on the wall. I mean, that's the best one, right?
That one's great, but it's not my favorite.
Ooh, what's your favorite?
My favorite is actually Linda's death when she's on the phone with Lori. And once again, where this movie just fucking works for me so well is when we have superior position over that of the characters. So this is right after Bob gets killed. So it's right after your sequence. And Michael decides to put on the sheet and pretend to be Bob.
Yeah, that's a
and
great
Linda's thing. Just talking to him. It's like, you know, fuck off, Bob. And
give me
he's
my
not
beer.
Talking. And he's having a. And Michael is playing. That's ultimately what he's doing. He's playing. He's a child.
Yeah.
He's a child in a man's body. And Linda has no reason to fear Bob.
Nope.
So she's like, fuck you. And she just goes and calls Lori. And then he comes up and strangles her. And if you think about it, Linda never saw his face. So
no.
She died thinking her boyfriend killed her.
Oh, that's true. Holy shit. That's true. I didn't even think about that. Yeah, because
so it's just fucking heartbreaking. She died thinking her boyfriend killed her because she never saw Michael's face.
Yeah, because in Zombies, the sheet comes off and she, you know, she sees that it's Myers. Holy shit! Interesting. Okay. Favorite character for both of us, I know, because you gave it away yesterday. Is Annie? Annie's the coolest.
Nancy Keys, or she was Nancy Loomis when she made that movie.
Yeah.
I fucking love her. Her former wife of Tommy Lee Wallace, and it was really funny when I met Tommy Lee Wallace. She was sitting at the table right across from him, and I was like, man, that has to be fucking awkward. Because they weren't together anymore.
Oh, jeez.
You know, she'd only been in a handful of movies, but I just love her in this movie. She is kind of an asshole, but in a way that, like, I just feel like she's kind of being a jerk to Lori, but in a way that I just feel like it's that way that friends rib each other.
Yeah.
And I just, like, one could argue that Jamie Lee Curtis or even PJ Souls are doing a better performance, but I just feel like Nancy as Annie is bringing so much more to that character, or is trying to build this performance, that I just every scene that she's in, I absolutely love her, and she just feels effortless.
Yeah, she's
and some people don't like her because, like, oh, she gives bad line deliveries. Yeah, but she is embodying this character so fucking well.
Yeah, she's great. I just love her. I just love the way she acted that character. I think she was fantastic. Like, mm-hmm. Lori is good as well, but you can tell she's not
it's
as
very different type of performance.
It's very different. Subdued. Yeah, you can tell that she's still, you know, she's still getting her acting chops, and now she's fucking, you know, she's one of the greatest actresses ever, in my opinion. I don't have a least favorite character. There wasn't anybody that I didn't like in this. Like, everyone has their likable qualities. There's not any men that I feel are, because usually in slashers there's that one kind of rapey guy and you're like, oh, you're kind of skeevy. There's no vibes
or
of that.
There's like a really dumb cop, and like,
yeah,
there wasn't in this, like, Charles Cyphers as Lee Brackett. He just
can't smell weed.
Yeah,
he just can't smell, like, marijuana.
He just chose not to say anything. His biggest flaw is that he is just choosing to keep his head in the sand.
Yeah.
About everything going
on. Pretty much, yeah.
But he's not an idiot.
No, he's not stupid. No. And yeah,
he's not like the guy from Black Christmas. That, you know, the deputy. Oblivious. That guy's a fucking idiot.
That guy's a moron. So yeah, like I said, I don't have a least favorite character. We've talked about the acting performances. Yeah, the cinematography in this movie is true. It's so 70s, and it is something that is missing from, you know, most of the other Halloween movies. It is just so well done.
I try to like rip off the look of this movie so often, and I can just never get it right.
It's how the camera moves and how they tell the story through the camera like lens. It's so, like I said, the opening scene in this movie is just utterly like flawless of how they move that camera around on Michael's perspective. And there's a pretty good one shot in there too. There's a lot of good like nice long takes in these movies or this movie, and it's just done so well.
He kind of shoots it like a Western. Like those are his big influences. Mm-hmm. And at this time, so this movie was shot in CinemaScope, or a rudimentary version of it. So they shot it with anamorphic lenses. And anamorphic lenses is what gives you those really wide shots with a little bit of curving around the edges. Because essentially what it does, when you shoot with anamorphic lenses, it shoots the image like truncated.
Yeah.
So it's like it's weirdly distorted, and then you play it back with a special lens that stretches it back out again.
Fun.
And you can do obviously a close up with an anamorphic lens, but it's like it can kind of distort an actor's face. So a lot of this movie lives in like a medium close up to a wide shot, and I think so also it has this like scanning the entire frame looking for things.
Yeah, that's what I was doing a lot and on this take. I'm just looking around, just trying to take the whole entire scene in.
Yeah, he uses negative space to his fucking advantage.
Yeah.
And like I said, if you watched my first student film, From the Darkness Theater, you can see a lot of Kundi's cinematography in that movie. I was definitely going for a vibe. And I don't think I did nearly as successfully as John Carpenter and Dean Koontz did, but you know, I'm not a master like they are. But this is a movie that I think a lot of people can learn from, and just the way the camera moves. Like I love, despite even when things are really tense, how the camera's kind of gliding
it's
through
floating yeah it's just yeah. The camera is just floating, and it's yeah. just it's so
they're
seamless.
Using a early version of Steadicam.
Yeah, and because usually when a camera is on a dolly or they're moving it, you can kind of, sometimes there's a little bit of rumble. This one is just like it's like on a fucking cloud. Like it's so seamless. Mm-hmm. And smooth. And of course the score goes along with it well. I mean, my only complaint on the score is that I think the theme might be a little overused, but I mean, it's John Carpenter's score. I'm not complaining.
I think he also didn't have a lot of time to compose this. If I'm remembering the story correctly, he showed a rough cut of this film to like the executives, and they're like, and it had no music.
Oh,
no, at all.
Oh yeah. That's his
so
score.
He's like, give me another chance and let me put some music in. And so he went home and composed this music based on something his dad taught him. Hmm. So this movie is in a 5/4 signature for time. And his dad used to play essentially play this time signature on the bongo drums. And he just took what his dad taught and was like, dun, 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 and just put it on a synth and just. That's where
it and then from. It was born the iconic.
Yeah, because his dad used to play that exact beat just on bongo drums.
Beautiful okay. Word. Yeah, I remember Nick telling us that it was in 5/4 on the Rare Exports episode, and I was like, oh my god, it is 5/4. I didn't even realize that until he said that. So is there anything else you'd like to ask or mention before we wrap up here?
Okay, let's dissect your thing of Halloween a little bit. So you said every time you've watched it, it's gone up a little bit.
It's gone up a little bit, yeah.
What's changed? Walk me through the Austin Proctor perspective of Halloween.
I don't know if there's anything that's really
changed. I'm making this difficult for you. I'm sorry.
No, I don't know if there's anything that's really changed. I guess I just appreciate it more every time I watch it, because I might notice something here or there, or maybe, you know, like this time I really noticed the cinematography. Sometimes I just don't pick up on things, you know, unless I'm actively looking
and
for
that's,
it.
And that's fair. Yeah.
So there's, you know, this go was, man, the cinematography is really great. I love how he uses the camera. I love how he fills the space. And it was also noticing the cues of once, like I said, once I read that haunted house line from that Wikipedia page, I was like, man, this is like a haunted house movie because there's a lot of loud boom, and it's just like, that's like a jump scare. I didn't realize how jump scary this movie was until I watched it on my surround sound, and I cranked it up very loud because it has that nice Atmos track with the 4K. So that was the first time really watching it with that soundtrack. So maybe, you know, maybe that had something to do with it. I also watched it with no distractions too, so maybe that had something to do with my appreciation for it more. But yeah, I've just, every time I've watched it, it's usually gone up like a little bit, and I'm like, okay, I can see the merit here for why everyone loves it. I know it's not gonna ever be my favorite, but I could see it possibly going up the next time I watch it. But after that, I can't go up anymore because it's not gonna be a 5-star movie from me. But the biggest problem is just the motivation, but I can only eventually knock that like half star. I can't knock that a full star. So right now,
no, the haunting thing is definitely a fascinating perspective on it because, yeah, you know, Michael, and this is something that all the other films kind of run with as well, is he is this specter that is haunting Haddonfield, and in this specific case, he is kind of just taking residence in the house.
Yeah,
it's just taking it kind of as his own. And one thing we didn't really talk about much with Loomis.
Oh, Loomis, yeah, Donald Pleasance.
He's arguably as insane as Michael Myers.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He's trying to take Brackett around town. It's like, no, I've seen him. And Brackett's like, I haven't seen him yet. He's like, I know what the evil is here. I'm like, do you know that, Loomis? Are you sure? He's just as bad.
There's that great scene where little Lonnie is like walking up to the Myers house and Loomis scares him. And then he has like this fucking sick smile on his face.
Yeah.
And I think like there's something to be said about their relationship, and some of the films after the fact kind of explore that, where, you know, it's kind of like that line from Austin Powers: "We're not so different, you and I." Yeah. like the only thing that really separates Loomis and Michael is Michael just gave in to his, you know, sick thoughts and hurt someone.
Yeah,
where Loomis has too much morality. But he has no qualms carrying a gun around trying to shoot this fucking patient.
Yeah, exactly. His patient for 15 years. He has problem.
You can't trust a man who just openly parks in a handicap parking spot.
Did he do that?
You watch that scene where he's leaving Smith's Grove,
yeah,
and he gets into his car and he's like, he was doing a good job last night.
Yeah.
And he pulls away. He's leaving a handicap parking spot.
That's a $250 fine, sir. That's fucking great.
And he doesn't have a limp or anything yet in this movie. He's just walking just fine.
Just fine. So I've got some taglines here for you. A lot of them are pretty good. The trick was to stay alive. The night he came home, he's come back. Everyone is entitled to one good scare, and trick or treat or die. I love all of those. I didn't do any trivia. There's way too much trivia about this movie. Like, there's so much. We'd be here all day if I wanted to tell you all that. I gave you my goofs. The POV sequence and Sheriff Brackett cannot smell weed, even though they've just finished smoking a doobie.
We don't know he can't smell it. He just chooses not to. And this is not a goof.
It is the 70s.
It's a movie that it's a moment that I've chose to just find really funny. It's when Loomis is waiting for Dr. Brackett and Michael is driving in the car behind him. Mm-hmm. And he just never looks in that direction. It just kills me every time.
Rated 7.7 out of 10 on IMDb, 3.8 out of 5 on Letterboxd. It is certified fresh with 96% on the tomato meter and an 89% audience score. Now it is at a 4 out of 5 for me. It was at a 3, then a 3.5, now a 4. So 4 out of 5, I assume this is a 5 out of 5 from you.
Yeah, it's no question.
Well, then,
I'd give it a 10 out of 5 if I could.
Then that's going to start the year off with a Frightmare certified slap-a-rooney. Similar movies according to Letterboxd, we have Halloween 2007, Scream, A Nightmare on Elm Street, Friday the 13th, and Black Christmas. And similar movies according to IMDb, we have Halloween 2, Halloween 2018, A Nightmare on Elm Street, Scream, and Friday the 13th. Let's read some good or funny reviews.
Can I ask you a quick question?
What's up?
What is the minimum star rating for something that have to be a slap?
Oh, fuck. I guess I've never really covered that. I probably should say that both of us have to rate the movie a 4 or higher for it to be a slap.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay.
I probably have never.
I always wondered that. I was like, ooh, what does that mean?
That's probably good that I explained that because I've never done that yet, I don't think. So, that's what qualifies a certified slap. We both have 4 reviews here. All of mine are good. I couldn't even find a bad one. Mine are all 3.5s are up, and they all are kind of funny. First one is from Karst, and it says, "Watched a day after Halloween because swirls head around. I'm different." Yeah, you're different. Got to watch it on the 1st instead of the 31st. What do you have?
All right, so this one says it's from Ciara. 4-star reviews and a heart. All this guy does is stand there breathing heavily. Like, damn, bitch, take a puff from your inhaler and go.
Beautiful. My next one is from James from 3.5 stars. John Carpenter putting the original thing on TV in this movie only to make his own thing a few years later is peak foreshadowing. I agree.
Yes.
Fucking nailed it.
I decided to, because I love this movie so much, I decided to go for shitty reviews.
Oh.
This next one. This is a 1/2-star review.
Oh, wow.
From someone named Avni. And their review says, "Lord, whoever said this movie is amazing needs a lobotomy."
Oh, man, that's rough. 4 stars from Fran Hopfner. "It's so good no one ever trusted me to babysit."
All right. This one is from SexMachine_3000. 1/2-star review. "This movie was so bad. It was boring, and the majority of the scary scenes were comedic at best. This movie is an uninspired pile of donkey garbage, and if anyone had the nerve to hand me a branded object from this movie, I would throw it in the trash faster than a Japanese baseball pitcher. This is what is wrong with film industry, and this series needs to die already. It's practically a TV show."
Oh, wow. Yeah. Wow. All right. 3.5 stars from Ellie. "Every teenage girl in this movie, semicolon, tits out for getting murdered." Yeah. All right. What you got? One more.
Let's see. This one's a 1/2-star. "What on earth was that? ... Oh, so this is from George's here. 1/2-star. "What on earth was that? ... 0.5-star for boobs."
0.5-star for boobs. I love it.
The movie doesn't even get a 1/2-star.
Wow, he just gets that. Yeah, it's just for the boobs. Yikes. Yikes. All right, Michael, where can everyone listen to the sultry sound of your voice on your podcast?
So I am the host and producer of a little podcast that could called The Shameless Picture Show. You can find that anywhere you listen to podcasts. That's Apple Podcasts, that's Spotify, that's Audible, that's Amazon, that's wherever the fuck you listen. As well as on the Cinepunks Network, that's CINEPUNX.com, has all the information about my show, other shows, articles, cool shit for movie punks. Check it out. And I guess I'm on Letterboxd as well as, I think, Michael_Virus, or is it Shadow10 2008? You remember better than I do.
I remember better than you. We can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and /@ Frightmares Podcast. Email us staysspooky@outlook.com. You can follow me personally on Letterboxd @DrProctor. You are Virus10 2008.
That's it.
Join us next week when me and Corey talk about John Carpenter's Prince of Darkness from 1987. And until then, stay tuned and stay spooky.
Stay spooky.
Stay spooky.